So, welcome to Dave and Michelle's Uncool Podcast. My name is Denise Houlihan, and your name is...
Randolph Partner.
Can you pronounce that?
Randolph Partner.
Oh, must be an ethnic name. So, Denise Houlihan here and James Partner. So we're just going to talk about
James or Randolph. You know, either one. Randolph James.
I know. Can I call you James? Can I give you a nickname? Can I be one of those people that just assign you a nickname, even though your name is not really difficult?
Yeah, like Randolph. Nickname for Randolph is James.
Because, you know, tomato, hanger, cotton, things that correlate. It makes sense.
Right.
Random. So, yeah. Anyway, welcome to the Dave and Michelle's Uncool Podcast. Shouts out to Dave and Michelle,
woo-hoo,
who sponsor the podcast.
Blah, blah, blah.
Do not ask us who Dave and Michelle are. Okay.
I have a funny story about Dave and Michelle.
Why? Why do you have a story that you need
to tell
us? I
won't tell it, but it's funny.
Well, you shouldn't tell us.
It's so funny. You got to hear Dave and Michelle.
No one asked
you. Because Dave, you know Dave. And then Michelle.
Yeah.
And Michelle was like...
But you know, Michelle, it's like, she's a pathological liar. Did you know that? Because she lied the other day when I was asking her where she was going.
Okay, well, moving on. First show topic. This is the first episode. We can't disparage our gracious sponsors.
You're right.
So.
Big ups, Dave and Michelle.
Blah!
Holler.
Big up. All right, so, fearless leader.
Yeah, so the first topic of discussion is going to be something very generic, just to get the juices flowing, just to get the banter going. So I want to know where you stand in terms of in the dating scene, when you were in the dating scene. Mm. Where do you stand in regards to going Dutch on a date? Is that something that you try to keep consistent with everybody that you take out, no matter what level of interest it is, whether it's a casual interest, whether it's maybe the third or fourth date? Do you try to keep it separate until you know for
separate
sure?
Separate but equal.
It's uncomfortable. And I think Dave and Michelle will be disappointed to hear that on the podcast.
Dave and Michelle's fine. So, I mean, going Dutch on... Well, I think personally... it's like one of the things where it's like, you know, damn if you do, damn if you don't. Like, I think you should go Dutch the first few dates. I feel like that's fair. That's even. That's progressive feminist movement, you know? Because, I mean, like, people don't like to hear this, but women can sometimes scam people in the same way that men can. If no. You believe it.
No, and I think men can also be a part of the scamming as well. It's just on the opposite spectrum of what they actually want. And I think women go into the situation automatically wanting to be a little bit more protective, being a little bit more protective in regards to what it is we have to bring to the table, but at the same time being open. So it's a little bit more of a, for lack of a better example, like a juggling act when it comes to us. So it's like, we don't have any problem keeping things separate, but it also depends on the personal philosophy as well. I know me myself, I don't have any problem with doing things separate. It kind of takes the weight off to kind of give me a chance to get to know the person that's in front of me.
Well, I think
versus being able to always be concerned with who's going to pay for what, and it always becomes to be an awkward conversation. So sometimes I like to discuss that before we go into the restaurant and things like that. But I think there should be a general cutoff for the individual. Like for me, if we've gone out on consistent dates, I would say about maybe like five, then we need to figure out where we're going. Are we just...
Well, see, and that's my thing. Like, I think there should be certain rules. I always thought this was a rule anyway, which has gotten me in trouble in the past.
And this is why, you know, a lot of things get messed up in translation, because a lot of people go with their assumptions off of the last messed up relationship they were in.
But I always was under the impression that if you are going out on a date with somebody and you suggest the spot or you suggest the act of eating lunch or having dinner, then that's on you completely. Now, if it's the other person suggesting it, like if it was the man saying, "Hey baby, let's go, you know, hey baby, let's go have some lunch."
It's uncomfortable.
It is.
Where's the voice coming
from? It is coming from the soul. Mm. But it's like, if you say, hey, let's have lunch, right? I know a spot. Let's, you know what I'm saying? Let's do it up. Then it's on me to pay for everybody, I would think. Because it's like, well, I don't know if that particular location is in your price range. And to be, you know, nice about it, it's like, or to be considerate, that's me offering like, okay, well, I'm paying for both of us if that's the case. But if it's just like the man talking to the woman suggests we should go have lunch, then we're going Dutch. I feel like that's fair because it's like, well, I'm not expecting you to pay for me, but I shouldn't be expected to pay for you and you pick Cheesecake Factory or something or Boulash Gumbo Mujumui and you want to have the duck. And I'm like, chick, it's lunch. You know?
The duck a la round.
Right.
The creme brulee.
It's 12 o'clock, dog. You don't have to have that.
But the thing is that I kind of struggle with is what happens when the man wants to take the woman out and they say, okay, well, where do you feel like going? And if I say a 5-star restaurant and this is supposed to be a dinner date that's planned maybe 2 days in advance and you're asking me where I want to go and I tell
you, that's why you don't give options. That's what I'm saying. Like if you suggested the location, then it should be on you to either go Dutch or to pay for both parties. Now this is my chauvinistic man view.
I'm glad you're connecting with the chauvinistic aspect. That's what this is.
But it's like if you go off of that, it's just like, well, the man is suggesting the location, then the man is paying for both parties. If I'm not suggesting the location, and I'm not even suggesting let's go out to lunch, let's just hang out, then wherever we go that spends money, I would assume that it's generally Dutch, unless I feel otherwise.
I feel like you know, audience members need to keep this in mind, because this is coming from a very extremely cheap, frugal person.
Yeah.
That will bring Groupons to the first date, and then look at you funny, because it looks cheap on their part and don't want to be judged for it. So it's like, and all things considered.
Yeah, it's like, this isn't coming from the standpoint of somebody who, I'm looking at it from, you know, back when I was on the dating scene, still in college kind of stuff. I mean, like, you don't have a whole lot of money to spare to begin with. So when you actually take someone out to dinner and you're paying for dinner for everybody, that's an investment. Like, that's not just, I'm just throwing some money out there, unless you just got it like that. But it's just like, well, if you don't have a whole lot of money, then you need to pick and choose when you're paying double for somebody to go out at a restaurant or something like that. So I think, you know, I think it's not unheard of for somebody to go Dutch. I think that's fair. But I don't think it should be automatically on the guy to pay for everybody no matter what. Because if that's the case, if you're playing the dating scene, you're going to be broke really fast.
True.
So, I mean, I think it's
if you're dating multiple people, which you should be dating multiple
people. Yeah, like, if you're just testing the waters, seeing what fish are out there kind of thing, like, and you're going on two dates a week or one date a week, that's still adding up. Mm-hmm. You're talking about $30, $40, $50 a week extra that you weren't anticipating on spending. So, I mean, I think it's one of those things that has to be fair. And I don't think I'm crazy for saying, well, at the bare minimum, the woman should at least pay for herself in some instances.
Okay, so my stance on it is basically Dutch is fine when it's cordial and casual in the beginning of the interactions and relationship. I feel like Dutch is a preliminary standard thing just to keep it even and fair and to take the mind off of money and get back to getting to know that person that you're sitting across from to figure out whether or not you even like them or whether or not they're even material that you want to be involved with, you know, the next week. So I feel like Dutch is fine, especially if you have a decent dating life and options where you're dating multiple people. I think keeping it Dutch might be a safe bet. However, when it comes down to winding down to maybe a person that you're interested in, I think, you know, being more mindful of the dates should be in consideration. But when I say more mindful, that means the date should also be more thoughtful. So it shouldn't always be a lunch date at Starbucks or IHOP or something like that. Not saying that that's the parameter of dates, because IHOP is not really considered a date for me. But
whatever.
Not for me.
You get that pancake breakfast. I mean,
no, I can.
The date's been had. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I can do IHOP takeout by myself, and then I can just call you later for conversation. But the thing is, I feel like, you know, Dutch is fine, especially if you have a larger dating life. you know, and you're dating multiple people at the same time, provided that, you know, everything is within healthy parameters. But when it winds down to a specific person that you're serious about, I think that, you know, the date, when the dates become a little bit more thoughtful and the conversation becomes a little bit more in tune to each other, which is only going to be gauged by the two people in that relationship, that's when they have to start reconsidering where this is going. And that's really based on the preference of that person. For me, I think, you know, I'm pretty much going to know whether or not I want to take it further with you, at least by date five.
Now, if I may, this is on a tangent. Going to. Mm-hmm. This is a tangent, though. Do people get, like, I don't know how people feel, because you mentioned, like, oh, if you're playing the dating scene kind of thing. Some people get really possessive off the first introduction. Like, people get really possessive, like, the first date, the first interaction kind of stuff. And it's just like, oh, you're dating, you going on a whole bunch of dates? I thought we were, you know, trying to see, you know, where this
was going. Well, that's none of your business. So, it's like,
and some people automatically peg you as like, oh, that dude must be the player then, if he's sitting there going around trying to date all these other people.
No, but how are you going to know who you want to be in a relationship with if you don't get to know several people? I mean,
I thought we were getting to know each other.
And we can get to know each other, but at the same time, whether or not I choose to talk to you about that information is my business. Now, everybody has a personal preference with that. I'm not going around dating 5 or 10 different people at the same time. See, I feel like it gets more complicated when sex is integrated into the dating mixture, and then you're still saying, let's keep it Dutch, let's keep it separate, let's keep it, you know, just you over there and I'm over here. Some people can do that. For me, if I'm dating several people, it's because it's no different than just hanging out. It's no different than just testing the water and seeing what's out there, seeing if I even want to be bothered with you, figuring out if you're annoying or if you're really interesting. But, you know, still trying to keep it within a healthy limit for myself. If I feel pressured and if I feel like there's an energy there where the guy may subconsciously expect something, even when I meet, you know, we have a mutual meeting spot, we hang out, we keep it Dutch, and we do things that are within a certain range that's comfortable for me. And if he says it's comfortable for him and I get the impression that there's an additional expectation there, then for me, I would want to address that with him and figure out, you know, hey, you know, just to make sure, like, you know, we're cool and I really like being around you and you're somebody that I want to continue dating, but, you know, you pressing up on me is something that makes me uncomfortable. I don't know if I want to take you there just yet. And if it's, you know, and if after that it's just dissolved, then so be it. But,
you know. Okay. Well, would you like to move on to the next topic?
Okay, so the next topic is,
because, you know, we're not a relationship show.
What if I want a relationship with you?
What if you don't?
What if I do?
What if you realize?
Because I kind of fell in love with you, like, when you were saying that you would pay for the 5-star restaurant, even though you kind of said you weren't going to pay for it, I was like, that's the kind of man I want.
Oh, baby, you know I ain't buying you nothing.
And when you did that voice, I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, you like the Cleophas
voice. I do like the Cleophas voice. Cleophas.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't want you to break my heart inside.
All right.
Okay, so the next topic is armchair revolutionaries. So, I mean, armchair revolutionaries, do we know what that is?
Okay, this was my definition, because I don't know if there's like a textbook. I'm sure there is.
Well, you can go to any 5%er meeting and they'll be willing to.
Whoa, easy.
And they'll be willing to define what armchair revolutionary is.
Easy. All right, but yeah, so the idea of armchair revolutionary, for the layman's out there, you know, the people that aren't down, people who aren't woke, which I hate that term, by the way.
Stay woke!
I like that song, hate that term. But, and maybe we can talk about that too. But armchair revolutionary basically is an individual who talks a good game about the revolution and changing the world, you know, and all this kind of stuff, but they don't leave their armchair. Like, they basically are sitting down, not getting out there and doing anything. And they just talk a good game and get other people to do other stuff or criticize other people for doing it. I've been an armchair revolutionary for quite some time. I would like to.
It's very honest. It's very bold of you to say that.
I'll admit it. You know, I critique more than I do. And I mean, I think a lot of people do. But I also feel like, me personally, I feel like I do my part to some degree. Like, I'm not going to completely down myself. Like, I think there are aspects that I could do more about. There's aspects that I do plenty fine. I would do more than others. So, I don't... Maybe I'm like a beanbag chair revolutionary. Like, I'm not resting my arms necessarily, but I am sitting down.
You ain't got no arms.
You ain't got no arms, Lieutenant Diet. But, yeah, I mean, you know, that's what I think. I think, when does an armchair revolutionary become not an armchair revolutionary?
When they actually make themselves active and make themselves seen at the risk of whatever
might be. But some could argue that even the act of talking is revolutionary.
Well, it depends on how you define revolution.
I mean, it sounds like a cheap way out of it, but...
Right, and it seems like if you're trying to just pull hair to that point to make... Well, I'm talking, so therefore...
I'm starting the conversation, my sister. You need to get on your dean. You need to get on your walk, my sister.
And there are certain people in the regions of the Americas that do that. And you can hang up on them, and they'll still be talking right to themselves. But the thing is...
Look at you, my beautiful black sister. While I sit here and criticize you... From afar. What you need to do.
Right, but the thing is, a lot of people, there are a lot of armchair revolutionaries out there, and I think a lot of them don't know who they are, but I think it's really interesting that you made yourself aware, saying that, hey, I think I've also been in that same position as an armchair revolutionary,
and not to anybody doing anything listening.
And to not do enough. But the thing is, we're talking about other people.
Right, so anybody listening out there, if you feel that you're an armchair revolutionary,
don't call us from your armchair and talk to us about it.
We love you. Something's telling me it might be you. All
of my life, it's you. Armchair revolutionaries, they disappoint me, and they also make me too concerned, because I wonder, like, what happened to make them get to that point. When you see people come into these community spaces and say, yeah, black people need to do this, black people need to do that, especially when they're not someone black, telling other black people how they should behave, how they should grieve, how they should be happy and joyful,
but, I mean,
and
how they should reach each other.
And it, but should it be there? And is it helpful?
Well, I mean... You can always say something shouldn't be or should be, but I think like that kind of stuff has always been around. Like, you've always had people that go hard and don't say any or don't do anything, but they just go hard talking. And I mean, like, it's always like that whole, like, I think armchair revolutionary was just a way to pigeonhole the people within, like, the radical quote unquote communities. But there was always that, like, there are talkers and there are doers. There are people who talk a good game, and there's people who actually just act. There's always that those people that stay on the sidelines when people go out and fight the war. Like, that's always what it's been. So it's like, armchair revolutionary was just a way of talking about or marginalizing those particular people within that segment of, like, the Black Power movement or, like, the radical movements in the 60s and 70s. That's what I think. But, and I'm just like, I mean, there's always going to be people around that are too scared to do anything. Mm. And too scared to... That feel more comfortable talking.
So armchair revolutionaries are people that are scared?
Maybe. Maybe because it's like they're aware that something's wrong, and they're aware that something needs to change, but they also may be afraid to act on some of those changes that need to be made. Because it's scary. Like, revolution is scary. Radical change is scary. No matter how violent or non-violent it is, it's a radical change, and it freaks people out.
But radical change is needed in order to develop as a human being on your journey, no matter what journey that is. So
yeah, but how many people...
Radical is subjective, but change is always necessary, though.
But that's the thing, though. But how many people don't want to change? Like, how many people still act like they're 16 years old? Or how many 40-year-old dudes or 50-year-old guys still try to go in the club with the 20-something-year-olds?
Or how many unproductive African-American women convince themselves that they're doing you a favor because, you know, of the way they treat you, even though it doesn't harbor any type of positivity, or if it doesn't move the conversation forward in terms of how can we come together and treat each other better. Well, revolution is something that can be radical change and not even feel like, hopefully having that domino effect to where we go home and want to treat our wives and our husbands differently. We want to treat our children differently. And then ultimately those things can grow and be better and can be infectious to improve. And I think when we speak of revolution, people always think of these elaborate demonstrations of revolution.
But those, that's what I'm looking at. Like, I think you're pigeonholing it in a way. Like, you're kind of saying that, well, you know, these changes, those changes are big, but at the same time, they're not as big as, you know, changing a government or something like that. But it's just like, those things are still, you know, freak people out. Those things still, like, affect people, and they don't want to do them. So it's like I said, like, you got cats that still walking around wearing some old Avirex stuff, you know, like 50-year-old dudes in Brooklyn and stuff still.
And they don't want to change out still, that Avirex for a respectable jacket,
right? And they're still out there acting like it's 95 and they're on the block, like, but you're 50, you know. And it's like, you don't want to get past that. You don't want to change that because to them that's change. Like, that's radical. That's a revolution.
I mean, I used to envy people that had Avirex jackets because
I mean, Avirex, they look comfortable.
They look comfortable and they look warm. They look like the minute you put on a jacket. Like,
I only use that as an example because I would still wear one. I would still wear one because it still seems like it's comfortable.
Washed.
Anyway, but yeah, like, I think, you know, I think even that, like, that could be revolutionary to somebody mentally. They might not want to. They might not want to give up that look or that feeling or those memories, and because they don't want to give those things up, they don't do anything. And the most they'll do is talk about changing. Because I know those people, you know. Oh man, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, I ain't nothing, but you know, I'm trying to change, you know. But you know, one day maybe, but they never do it because that's radical to them. And so, in turn, they rely on being the armchair revolutionary because that other kind of change is too drastic for them, even if it sounds like baby steps. I think everybody does that to some
degree. And I hear what you're saying. So basically, you're saying, like, what my idea of the individual face-to-face changing dynamics is something that's still just as grand as shifting a government.
Yeah.
And I agree, but it's like, if somebody is interested in change, no matter where you are, who you are, you can start off of simple stuff like that.
But who's to say that those things are simple? They might not be.
Well, yeah. I mean, it just depends on
getting rid of my Tim collection. That's not simple.
Well, why are you getting rid of your Tim collection?
Because I gotta wear the Doc Martens and go to the business.
Keep your Tims, but you need to always say hello to every black person that you see.
Can't do
and
that.
And be polite.
Like, you see what I'm saying? Like,
so maybe you need to reconsider whether or not you're ready for actual change.
But maybe they know, maybe they see the need for change, but they're afraid to do it. And they don't do it. And then who's pushing them to do it?
And
that's how they become.
But nobody can change. You have to want to change. You have to want to be that change that you seek, like you told my nephew the other day. And so it's like, you can notice the change that needs to happen and you can see how it could happen, but we all are agents of that change that we seek. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not we're willing to be continuing agents of that change, and what are we willing to do and how far we're willing to go in terms of doing something. The idea is that you have to do something and there has to be some type of movement in order for things to not wither and just die off. And so wherever your starting point is, somebody's starting point could be materialistic in terms of saying, well, I'm gonna get somebody to hand make my shoes versus getting Tim's because I don't want to patronize in that economic system anymore of purchasing Tim's that are made in factories and stuff like that. Somebody might find it easy to start there. Some other people might find it easy to start with just saying, well, hey, yeah, every time I see a black person, I'll go out my way to be more polite to them. Because more than likely, when I see somebody that's of African-American descent, there's somebody who's suffering in a way that I might not understand from trauma that we could be connected to, but I want to make sure that I'm extra polite to them in a way that I don't want somebody to be polite to me. And maybe that could be somebody else's starting point, but the commonality between the two people is that they're willing to start somewhere. And when you are willing to start somewhere, that involves some type of incremental movement, that's what makes you the difference between an armchair revolutionary and a true revolutionary.
You're right.
So you sound like one of those ignorant people that's not listening.
You're right.
People don't listen, they be like,
word.
But what I was saying, like, word. You ain't hear shit I was saying.
True. But you know what? You're right. You absolutely right. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get my FUBU out the closet.
Oh, no.
I'm going to go down to the nearest Goodwill and I'm going to make a donation. And then I'm going to start wearing skinny jeans and ill-fitting t-shirts.
I mean, you have
to. Revolution. Viva la revolution.
I mean, you got to start somewhere.
And I'll start by restricting circulation.
So the next topic is prenuptial agreements. Just kidding. Prenuptial agreements. Necessary, not necessary. Do men ask for more than women?
Real quick, what's a prenatal agreement?
I don't know. What do you think it is?
I'm not paying for that baby.
Oh, he struggled with that joke, guys. Make sure you enter the crickets noise for bad jokes. Crickets. So anyway.
But I'll add a cricket in for every.
You're upset.
Every,
okay.
Prenuptial agreements. This sounds like an interesting topic.
Well, you can talk about something else then. I mean, I was the one who followed the rules and I came up with three interesting topics that could go off into any direction. He was like, yeah. So anyway,
I was like, what?
I don't know. So anyway, prenuptial agreements. Mm. Do you think men ask for them more? Do you think there's a new trend where women are starting to advocate for them more to keep everything separate? Do you think that starts the marriage off in a bad space? Should they be private between the married couple? Or should it just be something that all people should consider?
I think men typically ask for them, except for when the woman is coming to the table with more than the man. And when the woman comes to the table with more than the man, she asks for a prenuptial agreement or she expects one. And I think men, when they're coming to the table with more, I think it's on the table always. Mm. But I think at the same time, men can be dumb when they meet people. And they'll be less likely to adhere to it. So it's like, okay, well, I'll get a prenuptial. I'll think about getting this prenuptial agreement because I'm a millionaire and I just, you know, I'm 60 years old and I just married this 21-year-old. I'm getting a prenup, you know, right out the gate. But there could be a way that her feminine wiles, I'm blinded by her feminine wiles, and then I'll not agree to a prenup. I don't think. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's examples out there. I haven't done my research on this topic. But I wonder if there are women who come to the table with a certain amount of wealth or whatever, and then they originally are planning on agreeing on a prenuptial agreement with a man, and then don't.
Back off.
And they back off because of his masculine wiles.
You have to start using a better term than masculine wiles.
No. Feminism. Okay? There could be feminine wiles, there are masculine wiles, all right?
Well, that's a good way to use reverse feminism. That's fine.
Reverse feminism? What's reverse feminism?
Oh, is it reverse racism? To pedal off. Yeah.
No. There should be masculine. I mean, like, if that is the same concept, it's like this young, strapping 21-year-old and his sugar mama, and he's getting over.
And, you know, I would be interested to know that statistic. I would be interested to know.
It's probably not high at all.
But it has to be. I mean, now you see a lot more women in the industry.
In cougars, Hollywood. They call them. They call them cougars.
But there are younger women that are in the industry in terms of politics, in terms of Hollywood, in terms cougars. Of, you know, young entrepreneurs that are out here and that are amassing large sums of wealth that have to be more mindful with their money, including. You know, with whatever assets in terms of who they merge them with when they get married. So I think there could be a trajectory out here that's shifting towards women being more protective of their assets and coming to the conversation like, hey, I want a prenuptial for me.
Unless that man is so sure about the system of patriarchy in this country that he's like, despite your wealth, I can make double that in my lifetime. So I don't even have to worry about a prenup. So even if you're starting off more wealthy than me, I can probably eclipse you faster than you were to keep that gap in between.
I still don't get any part of that. The amount that you would be eclipsing me by.
Oh, yeah. Never mind. You would get that, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. Because it was like, because if we're already married and then I make $1 million while we're married, then that $1 million is split generally.
So I think nobody wants to marry that guy because he clearly doesn't think shit through. And you're going to edit it out, right? And then, so that guy might be under scrutiny during the dating process when you're going Dutch because he might not be somebody you want to marry, see? But anyway.
Full circle, right?
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think there could be a different trajectory out here with women coming to the table asking for prenuptial agreements. But for me personally, I could see if you asked for a prenuptial agreement and you was coming to the door with, I don't know, like a couple million in your pocket, and I couldn't match that in assets. And I could understand you asking for a prenuptial agreement. I probably would have to negotiate my way through that, and then there would probably be an emotional struggle for me because I wouldn't feel comfortable coming into a relationship with a prenuptial agreement. And
just come in the game just waiting to take somebody's money, or you're always thinking that. Well, I don't get it, like, because you're more worried, like, you just don't trust them now.
It's whatever I have, I'm giving you everything I have, and
that's deep.
And I'm investing everything into this relationship. Not just the emotional piece, but whatever wealth I amass, whatever resources I accrue, you know, family, hardship. I mean, I said it was going to make the emotional thing separate, but you get all of me. Prenuptial agreements does not feel like I get all of you, even in a connection sense. And so it's just really rough to kind of navigate through what that means to me, because you're already making a statement on what it means to you financially. And so for me, I don't think I could be with anybody that essentially comes to the relationship like, yeah, I want a prenuptial agreement off the bat. No questions asked. This is what I'm offering you. Now, I could see. Now, I think there are certain types of prenuptial agreements where you can argue a certain stakeholdership in the marriage. Where
that's too much
even
work.
If you devour, even if the marriage dissolves or whatever, I can still come away with a cap amount. But even after I come away with a cap amount, I still can't go for everything that you have.
Whatever happened to marrying for love?
People get broke at the end. Credit scores fail. Mm. Houses get repossessed. Cars get taken away.
Well,
kids eat ramen noodles.
Kids will be already on ramen noodles, okay? I grew up on ramen noodles. There was, there was love was enough to get us by.
Yeah, love and sodium. That works. The thing is,
they both affect your heart.
That's horrible.
But
I don't know. It's like on one end, I would like to think, I'd be cool about it, and so I'm like, yeah, if you have mass and this much, but I would struggle with it initially because I'm the female that other females love to hate. I would have, I would have an emotional response to that. I don't think I would want to initially go into a relationship talking about separation of things. If I was more well-versed in prenuptial agreements to understand the different degrees of what could be offered in terms of what I could be offered in the event something severs, and the type of package I could walk away with, like a severance package, maybe I could see. But if you're talking about the flat-out traditional prenuptial agreements where, like, you get zip and that's it.
Can I be real with you right now?
After I finish my statement. And if it's, like, one of those traditional prenuptial agreements where I get nothing, then I'm like, well, no, I'm just not down with that. Because if I'm going to be putting everything that I have up to the table, you don't know what I could amass from day one up until year five. The likelihood, don't give me a look. But you,
because you just hushed me, that's all.
Well, I just prefer to finish my statement. You get long-winded too. But the thing is, it's like,
you literally finger pointed at me just now.
But you know, it's like you, for me, I want to go into the relationship being able to be completely married to you in every sense of the word, in terms of finances as well as the emotional aspect of it. And if you come into the relationship not willing to offer that same thing, I feel like we're not on the same page. But this is something that I would get indication of before we even talk about engagement. Because if you're the type to have a prenuptial agreement, you need to tell me this by like date 2 and 5. When we're still going Dutch, and when I still are, I'm trying to get to know you, and I'm trying to decide on whether or not you want the friend pile or the more than friend pile, you know.
I think that you're only saying all of this because you're not rich.
And hopefully you edit that out, Randolph partner.
But I think people say things like that because they're not filthy. Like, if you got like Michael Jackson money and one person can come in there and take it all or take half of it, and all of a sudden you gotta give up Neverland Ranch, like, I don't think that you would.
And that's why I say, you know, as a disclosure, I'm not well versed in prenuptial agreements. There might be other types of agreements out there that still classify as prenuptial agreements, where you still get something but you can't take anybody to court, you can't ask for anything in addition to that. And if somebody that had amassed all this wealth was talking on that tip, then maybe I would consider it. But if they're talking about prenuptial where you get zero flat out, no matter what.
You only get what you earn post-union. But like that person, like whatever you brought to the table when we got married and whatever they brought to the table when they got married, that's what you guys have when you leave. With the exception of whatever you guys amassed together. But... And that's what I'm saying. Like, if you were sitting on some Michael Jackson money, and you married somebody who had like negative Michael Jackson money, and then you guys get together and then divorce within like a year or two, they get half of all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, well, you didn't make Thriller, so it's like, why should you get half?
We didn't make that into like a phrase just to re-enter in other shows. You didn't make Thriller.
You didn't. It's like, well, you didn't earn this. You didn't earn. You didn't earn the giraffe.
You didn't make Thriller.
That's my giraffe. You didn't earn that. And so it's like, well, you know, I think that part of it is just like, well, sure. I'm like, we don't need a prenup right now. I'm broke. So if we make money together, I'm still walking out with a positive. Like if we separate and earn, and I earned, or we collectively earned like $1 million between the two of us, and I'm walking away with $500,000. That's $500,000 more than what I had when I was single. So it's different than I started off with.
But see, that's why I feel like, no, if I was Michael Jackson rich, like you pointed out that I wasn't, I would want to do like a severance package type prenuptial agreement. So if the guy that I'm with has negative Michael Jackson money and I have plus pro, you know, Michael Jackson money, he's coming to the table and I'm like, after 3 years or something, the severance package is a non-negotiable $200,000. You're not taking me to court. You're not getting any health benefits, and you can't take me to court for child support, but that's what you get flat out. And that's your rate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could see doing something like that.
Yeah, it's a prenup.
Not all prenups are going to be worded in that type of jargon.
They're just prenuptial, like prenuptial agreement.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, if I was on that type of status, no, I wouldn't. I want to make sure I don't get taken to court for anything, but I would give you something. It just would be almost like a subsidized pay. Say, hey, thanks for playing. Here's your courtesy money.
Courtesy.
Okay, so the next topic is Black-ish, randomly.
Yeah.
Do we like it? Do we hate it? Do we understand it? Does it speak to the topics of today of Black folk? Who watches that show?
White people. But I think in the Cosby-less era that we are currently living in.
Cosby-less.
I think Black-ish is trying to fill that void.
Mm.
And I don't think they I don't think they really... Yeah, like, I don't think anybody can.
They can't, and they need to just give up in the event that they're trying to fill
it. Well, they can't necessarily give up at this point because, first of all, it's proving successful. Secondly, I mean, if you give up at this point, it's like, well, you don't have a show. Because the whole point was that it was kind of supposed to be, like, a more modern, like, Cosby show, you know? But,
except they actually followed the script.
I guess so. Because Bill Cosby was notorious for never following that.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's not so much the script. It's like, you follow the rules and you do what we tell you to do. You don't run anything.
Yeah.
But it's Black-ish funny. Because every time I watched it, I never found anything funny. And somebody always had to point out a specific episode that was like 2 to 3 minutes long. Like, this thing that I saw was funny.
Well,
and
that's like,
okay, that's funny. But it's not going to make me want to all of a sudden watch it again.
That's how I looked at it. Like, parts of it were funny. Specific things, like, specific jokes were funny, but it wasn't like, oh, man, this show was so hilarious. Well, I got to watch the next episode.
Make you feel like
episode.
You're missing something.
Oh, man, this show was so progressive. It was so different, and I haven't seen anything like it on television. There were, like, a dozen shows like that on UPN and WB at one time.
Because, for real, I feel like it's the show that the interracial couple can watch together and feel comfortable watching together.
Yeah.
And they don't have to explain too much to the white audience or their white significant other without feeling completely detached. Because for me, I feel like Black-ish is just a show that white people can watch and feel good about watching in regards to what is black life like.
Yeah.
And for that, it turns me off. I saw one episode. It was really, really brief that I looked at it.
Well, don't try to front like you don't watch Black-ish.
I don't watch Black-ish.
You love that show.
No. And so, you know, they were explaining what a 5%er was because I think Anthony
Anderson.
And it was funny because he went on The View the other day and Joy Behar called him Anthony Henderson.
Ouch.
And I was
she
like...
She hidden fences his name, huh?
Yes, hidden fenced his name. That is perfect. Hidden fenced his name. And you saw the look on his face because, you know, they were like, and we'll be right back. Anthony Henderson, everybody. Woo! And then they put the camera right back on him and he was like... I can't correct it right now.
All those years scratching and surviving and hang time.
Scratching and surviving.
Because you remember that show Hang Time? It used to be on NBC. It was like NBC Saturday mornings. And Anthony Anderson was on it. I didn't like him back then either. Well, I like him more now. I'll say that much. But I couldn't stand him on Hang Time. It was a show. It was like high school basketball players or something. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, my sister loved watching that. Mm-hmm. And it had like the worst, you know how all these shows in the 90s had like some of the worst or best theme songs ever.
Yeah, Randolph Burton.
And it was like, Hang Time, riding together.
The one guy that always sung.
Me and my friends at Hang Time.
Aerial view of the house in the 90s. Succumbing mom and dad watching this on TGIF.
We were supposed to believe that Anthony Anderson was a star player on a basketball team, and he was bigger than he is now.
Nothing satisfies the teddy bear more than the family platter.
I thought the family platter serves four.
It does. That's why I'm so satisfied.
I was like, duh. And at the beginning of the show, Hang Time, and you see him running down the court doing like,
awful,
I was like, dude, he's doing suicides on the court. Like, get out of here, dog. You weigh like 270 pounds. You should be on a football field. What are you talking about, dog?
As soon as I lose a few pounds, I'll quit. I promise.
Like, I was like, I couldn't believe that. So anyway, I didn't like him back then because I thought he was overacting and all sort of stuff. I felt like he's since refined his acting. He's a better actor. I like his work, you know. He was decent in other stuff I've seen him in. Black-ish, I think, just tries too hard.
It does.
I think Black-ish took the mantle of his character from Hang Time. And basically, it embodies what his character in Hang Time is doing. But he has become a better actor.
Mm.
But the show, I think it just tries too hard. I think it does.
It almost seems like the show that they just want white and interracial couples to watch and feel good about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and that's like Jerome.
Because let's be clear, white people aren't going to watch any sitcom where they have a lot of black niche jokes that we understand and that we get, and not include them in explaining what that joke is. And it's weird because watching some of the 90s sitcoms, there were some things that were on different 90s sitcoms that I saw. I was like, yeah, white audiences aren't going to get that, but they didn't explain it to them either. Mm-hmm. And I think that narrows down the patience for the white audience, because it's like, well, I know I'm laughing, but I'm not laughing at the intended joke turn. So one thing that annoyed me about Black-ish is they went as far as to have Anthony Anderson do like a thing of him being a 5%er and that being a phase. And that's when I was like, I'm not watching this shit.
I mean, that could be funny, but like, I think, like, again, like, it's like you sanitizing it and then washing it over and then handing it back to people to explain to them certain
things. And that's what it was. It's like they spent, even if it was, maybe I turned away too soon from the joke, but they spent an unnecessary amount of time explaining what being a 5%er is and what it meant to him to be that amongst his friends and stuff like that. And to me, I was like, that's pandering. I feel like that's inappropriately enforcing another masculine male stereotype about black men. And then it's like, who are you explaining this to? You're not explaining it to us primarily, because by and large, we're not watching that. We're watching Empire.
And it reminds me of like the episode of Martin when Martin was looking for the his CD player.
Yes, my favorite.
And he was mimicking the scene out of New Jack City.
Exactly.
And they didn't explain that he was acting like Wesley Snipes in New Jack City at all. They didn't explain that they reset that whole scene. He had him wear black on purpose to look like the characters in that movie. And that he had that stuffed dog. And it was like, they didn't explain any of that stuff. And it was just like, either you knew what he was doing or you didn't. But either way, it was funny. But it was even funnier if you knew what he was doing.
And Martin has been paying for that ever since, with dressing up in these fat costumes.
Yo, you leave Martin
as
alone.
That grandma. He's been paying for it, I think.
And it's not grandmom, it's Big Mama, okay?
Whoever. I mean, obviously someone watches those shows. But the thing is,
he has been paying
for it ever since, because it was like, how dare you create a show that is funny, that black people enjoy watching, and you create all these in jokes with black people in mind and not explain anything to your white audience. But it's like, we shouldn't have to, because on Seinfeld, they don't have to explain certain things to us, and they don't seek to speak to us or include us in any episode.
And Jerry Seinfeld, you need to explain, because I know you're listening, explain why you had all that daggone cereal in the kitchen. Like, what was the point? I mean, granted, I envied that because I love cereal, but why did you have that much cereal? And some of it had to have been expired by then. Like, you're not eating that much cereal.
Or maybe he was, because were there ever episodes that he cooked or anybody cooked over his house?
Well, they're New Yorkers. They always eat out, right?
And if you don't want to eat out, what's the next thing you're going to eat?
Yeah, cereal, I guess, yeah. But they never get like a gallon of milk. You never just see them get like gallons of milk. You see them have like a half gallon. Just like in another thing about these sitcoms, you ever notice they always get like a cup of juice out the fridge and they take like a half a sip, maybe, and then leave it on the counter or leave it on the table and nobody ever touches it again?
And the one thing that pissed me off about that was Bill Cosby, The Cosby Show.
Theo was notorious.
Theo would do it, and I forget the apple juice that he had. What was the brand of it that they...
I don't know, but it always looked good. Cause
it always looked good, and it was these short, stout glasses of apple juice, and you would always hear it and just pop, and it just seemed fresh. And then he would just... and I was like, oh, it looks so good. And then he would put it down and leave it. I was like, you left a perfectly good apple juice, and then somebody's going to spit in it as soon as you leave. I was like, why?
Why would somebody spit in it?
Because that's what everyone does when you leave stuff on the counter.
So don't leave anything around Houlihan. Noted.
Randolph partner, I think you're stepping out of bounds right now.
Yeah, she'll spit in your drink. That's like...
So, the next segment is something that we're going to do...
Oh, wait. I have one other thing I want to talk about. Squirrels. So, squirrels. Another observation. Why are people okay with squirrels being around? Like, not in existence, but just around, like, their homes and...
Well, they mind their business. They go up trees.
They're rats. They're rats that climb trees with furry tails.
Are they classified as rodents?
They're rodents. They are rodents, dog. And they are everywhere.
But they're acceptable, cute rodents that we can live with.
What makes them cute? The bushy tail, and that's
it. The tail, their little face.
Their face looks their like a hands. Stout rat. That's it. It looks like a stout rat.
It doesn't.
Yeah, it does. It's the tail. The tail is the thing that really sells them. Because if a squirrel had a tail like a rat, you would say, ew, get that deformed, smushed face rat out of here. Squirrels. And it's climbing trees. Look at it. Ew.
Squirrels are wonderful creatures. They're majestic creatures that offer whatever. A lot to our society.
And people are too comfortable with them being all around. I'm like, if that was a rat, it would be a problem. But for some reason, because it's a squirrel and because it climbs trees and eats acorns and whatever else you throw on the ground like a rat.
And I think is there commercialization around squirrels? Because every time you see squirrels in like a commercial, it's always fall, it's always a neighborhood, it's always like a park. Yeah. It's always associated with these positive imagery components to make you think squirrels, fall, leaves, colors, family, park, trees, happiness, cinnamon. You know,
but you see squirrels in the hood too, and that should tell you that they're rodents. Because in like you don't have a plethora of wildlife in certain hoods. Sometimes you do, but when you do see the wildlife in like rundown bad neighborhoods, it's like certain kinds of things that you need to that it should tip something off to you that like. These creatures in particular are probably no good. Raccoons, possums,
I think the squirrels. Campaign around squirrels should change in order for people to create an awareness. So now you need to start inserting squirrels in like don't smoke commercials. And you need to start inserting squirrels in like these addiction counseling commercials. Just have a squirrel run across. And just,
yeah.
The association with squirrels needs to change in order for people to understand the awareness around what they are. They're rats, and they're just a upscale, they're just a rat in a nicer coat, but they're rats that need to be exterminated.
Right. Just like,
I still think it's ridiculous. I think squirrels are just great.
Like at the end of Departed, when that little rat's walking across the balcony, it needs to be a squirrel.
But then, I don't know what to feel with seeing that in the last scene of Departed, because if a squirrel walks, but I'm like, oh, it's fall.
Oh, it's a beautiful
fall
neighborhood.
Fall is going to set in. The leaves are going to start falling. Oh, and this guy is dead and bleeding to death on his own parquet floor.
Okay, I'll end the segment just like this. You can believe whatever you want, but the bubonic plague was carried by rats. But squirrels can also carry it as well. The end.
Here we go, Fonz! I'm heading for the ramp! Are you sure you want to do it?
We'll do it live! Fuck it! Do it live!
So, one thing that we're going to be doing on a weekly basis is a segment called Jumping the Shark. If you don't know what Jumping the Shark is, it's in reference to something that was in a sitcom from Happy Days. You want to explain it?
It was an episode of Happy Days that everybody says this is the decline of Happy Days, starting from this episode. And it was an episode in which Fonzarelli, the Fonz, he jumped over a shark in the water. So like, you know, Ron Howard's character, I forgot his name, Opie. No, well, same guy, but whatever his character was.
I don't
was
watch
in.
Happy Days.
Well, I said his name in Andy Griffith, but either way, that guy, the director. When he was riding the boat or whatever, driving the boat, and Fonzie was in the back with a leather jacket on, water skiing, and he was gonna hit a ramp and jump over a shark. And for some reason, I don't know what, I didn't watch the whole episode, because by then Happy Days was terrible. Get it? So when you jump over the shark, that became an industry-wide term of when the show basically just gave up. When it stopped trying. When it's all down here from here. And downhill. It never gets downhill from here, and it never gets better. Some people say, like when the Cosby Show got Olivia, that was it jumping the shark. And then another sign of it jumping the shark was Cousin Pam.
Like maybe.
That's what they say. So that was it jumping the shark. Now, there were other shows, Walking Dead, Glenn falling underneath the dumpster and scurrying under the dumpster. That was it. That was them jumping the shark. You know, there's a bunch of different shows, a bunch of different examples and stuff. But basically, when the show gives up and the ratings go down, that's it jumping the shark. Point of no return.
And the thing that I found interesting is I had to actually go back and watch the Happy Days episode where Fonz actually jumped the shark. He's wearing his leather jacket that he normally wears, and he's wearing cut off booty Daisy Duke shorts while he's water skiing. And he looks like one of those never nude people on Arrested Development. I like watching Arrested Development because it has very horrible and strange humor, but as soon as I saw it, I busted out laughing because I was like, he looks so fucking ridiculous. So the thing is, the second one on the show is basically going to be like, who basically gave up this week? Who was on the downtrod? And we basically are going to do that through, you know, who jumped the shark.
And it's funny that you mentioned that that Fonzie looked like a never knew because Henry Winkler was actually in Arrested Development too. So
yeah,
the more you know.
Yes, and that's why I was like, I wonder if maybe that's why they always included it in the one guy's character being a never nude. Mm-hmm. And then the show didn't even last that long.
Yeah,
so maybe it was like an ongoing joke of like they're constantly jumping the shark. Because every so often they'll have him walking around the house with those cut-off shorts on.
And Ron Howard did the narration.
That show was hilarious, but when they brought it back on a fourth season on Netflix,
it jumped the shark.
It officially jumped the shark. It was over, son.
Okay, so in our segment, leading into our segment.
So, for you, who jumped the shark? Who's jumping the shark?
This week, I would say the Kardashian family. And not for any particular reason, like not for anything that they did this week, because I don't really keep up with the Kardashians. I don't really watch the show. But the one time I watched the show was this past week. And then I was like, oh, they officially jumped the shark, because they made a whole thing out of Kim Kardashian being robbed, you know, and like they made it into an episode and there was all this, you know, hoopla about it. And I was just like, remember when, you know, when they just needed Kim Kardashian to have a sex tape, and then from there they were set, they were good, and they just had a TV show, and people were interested in them. Then they had to actually like reinject drama into their lives in order to keep the wheel turning, you know. And so I feel like they kind of jumped the shark. And then watching them pretend to like Kanye West's music, well, I don't know if they were pretending.
A lot of people pretend to like Kanye West's music, especially now.
Ouch.
I know.
All right. So, the Kardashians. So, moving on.
So, the Republican Party jumped a shark.
Indeed.
They've been jumping the shark for a while. This has been an ongoing discussion. But I feel like they officially jumped the shark for me with this healthcare bill that they're trying to pass to basically eject Obamacare. And that's absolutely ridiculous that they're even pursuing it to this level. And the Republican Party knows that they're going to fail, but it's almost like they're willing to stay on the ship that they know is sinking at this point. And, you know, and then they keep just conjuring up all of these different scandals that there's, you know, that have nothing to do with the healthcare bill that they're proposing. And then they're willing to defund a lot of programs, and then they're dismantling the education system. They're doing a whole lot to satisfy none, and they're just giving up. And I guess the reverse aspect is like, well, no, they'll be fine. They're just giving up on the people. But with them giving up on the public and with them taking away resources so people can not be able to support themselves and their family, they're causing more confusion and they're causing more disruption in our society. But the Republican Party has always been awful, but now they're really putting the nail in the coffin. So the Republican Party, for me, is collectively jumping the shark.
But and they haven't really even done anything yet. Like, even all the stuff that everybody is freaking out about, nothing's even really passed.
But they're posturing themselves with all this rhetoric to basically fear-monger the public to say, look, we're going to take away education. Look, we're going to make everything charter schools. Look, you're not going to have health care anymore. Look at all these things. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Just feeding on that aspect to put people in such of a frenzy instead of reestablishing a certain level of calm to where it's just like, we have your interest. It's possible for Republicans to do that, but it's like they're not even interested in doing the smaller thing.
See, they're basically doing what Kim Kardashian was doing when I watched that show. Like, constantly throwing stuff out there to re-inject interest. pay attention to us, because look, we're gutting this.
But then it's like, they always, it's easy to throw Donald Trump on the bus and just say, oh, well, he's always trying to create these elaborate distractions and attention drawing to themselves, but aren't the Republican parties doing that as a larger effort? And they just put Donald Trump out there, just like, see, he's the one responding to his Twitter account. Just like, but all you guys have Twitter accounts and are inappropriately updating you guys' status to talk about absolutely nothing and using that to try to stir in your voters and also upset other people that you know you need as allies that are going to make it harder for you to pass anything.
Except for, what's his name, Steve King. He was saying all that racist stuff. Talking about other people's babies and demographics and all that kind of junk.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, in terms of your jumping the shark pig. But I also used to feel like the Republican Party, like, maybe they're jumping a series of sharks. Because it's like, I think their first intro shark was Sarah Palin.
They gave up.
Or, no, maybe their first intro shark, their baby shark, was, you know, the whole Bush administration. And then Sarah Palin was like...
Official.
That was a great white. Let's be honest. Because, I mean...
They jumped that great.
They were like, oh, no, Obama's going to pick Hillary for his running mate, so let's get a you, Alaska. Me? And then that's what happened. And she was the worst. And she's still out here talking. So, yeah. I mean, but then they just kept getting worse, because then you had the Tea Party people and they were wearing like the tri-corner hats and ringing bells and stuff. Like, these people were crazy. But I mean, yeah, but now they're really desperate right now. Like, they're really acting out. So, I agree. I agree with your pick on that one.
So I made a mistake.
What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
And so now this is going to come to the conclusion of the end of our first podcast.
Yay!
Of Dave and Michelle's Uncool Podcast.
Congratulations, we did it.
We did do it. And as always, I'm going to leave off with saying, always go towards forgiveness and compassion. And what is your last thoughts?
Reach for the stars and keep your head to the sky.
Yes, always end off with a Earth, Wind, and Fire quote. So,
I thought that was Casey Kasem.
Randolph partner, we're done.
All right, partner in Houlihan.
I prefer you to call me as Denise, because I don't like you calling my last name. I think my husband wouldn't appreciate you calling me
Houlihan. Partner in Houlihan.
It's Denise. Thank you, and we will see you next time.
That felt really uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable. Yeah.